So, Berto, have you listened to that new podcast called Dirty John?
I did, yes.
What do you think of the title of that podcast called Dirty John?
It's a provocative title.
Yeah. I had some other podcast I listened to was advertising for it, and they played a little bit of it. And I just said, I think I've had enough of these kinds of podcasts where there's some psychopath that does something horrible.
Sure.
And the way they're presenting it, it's like, ooh, scary, you know. I feel like there's this huge trend on podcast in the podcast world right now where everything has to be scary.
Sure, yeah.
Like in the mid 2000s, when we came on the scene in 2008, they were mainly educational.
Yeah, very topic driven. Like, yeah. I listened to some that were video game related and stuff like that.
Right, and then it seemed like there were like sciencey kinds of podcasts. Mm-hmm. You know, Radio Lab and this sort of thing. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like overnight, every popular podcast now is basically mini documentaries on the scariest human stuff that's ever, sure. You know?
Whereas I thought, when I heard the title, I thought it was about prostitution.
Well, that's funny. That didn't even occur to me. So at first I was like, yeah, I think I've had enough of this sort of thing, and there's so many other great podcasts out there that I'm behind on listening to. So, but then you reached out to me and you're like, hey, have you heard this Dirty John podcast? Mm-hmm. We should do an episode on it. And I looked at it and it's only like 7 episodes.
6, I think, yeah.
Okay. And it's not very doesn't take very long to listen
to. No, it's not a huge investment.
It's probably like what, 4 hours, 3 hours or something.
Right.
And so, and it has an ending. It's not like an open-ended thing. It's basically one story in about 3 hours of listening.
Right. And one thing I liked about, we haven't even started the...
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Beto?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I train people on how to use fidget spinners correctly.
So, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that, like... You know, I literally did think it was about prostitution because I thought, you know, a John, Dirty John, you know. The only reason I started listening to it is because I was scrolling through Dig, and I saw this thing and I was like, oh, Dirty John. But I didn't like think about it. I thought, oh, it must be about prostitution. And then it came up again and I saw something about like the picture of the guy, and it said something about like, you know, this, it did make it sound like sort of scary. And I was like, okay. And I started listening. But I actually found that what was fascinating to me is that I was expecting it to be like, and here was his first murder and here was a second murder.
Right.
But what was so much real and more relatable on everyday life was that, yeah, this was a psychopath type person, but sort of a person you could run into.
Yeah. So we're going to spoil the whole thing.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Because we hate having to edit ourselves. Yes. So, and it does have a surprise ending. Mm-hmm. That isn't like, if it was spoiled for you, if it was spoiled for me, it wouldn't completely ruin it for me.
No.
But it is a twist at the end.
Yeah.
But really the big appeal of this podcast is just... hearing about the story, and so it can't really be spoiled in my view. But basically, it's about a woman, Deborah. She's a successful interior designer. You know, she's a woman who's, I think, been married like 3 other times or something.
And she's wealthy.
And she's in her 50s or something. And she meets a guy named John, and he's a handsome, on like Match.com or something. And he's a handsome man who... seems to have it all. He's attractive. He's single. He's a doctor with Doctors Without Borders. He's done all these dashing things jumped out of helicopters in Iraq and everything.
And he's an anesthesiologist. How do you say it? Anesthesiologist?
Anesthetician?
Anesthetician.
Wait, no. Anesthesiologist.
Anesthesiologist. Anesthesiologist.
Esthetician is something else.
I don't know why it's so hard.
Well, I don't know either. But he makes people fall asleep so you can be cut into at surgery. But... Her, so, you know, she meets this guy in Match and she starts dating him, And her family, her kids, her two daughters in particular, hate this guy.
Immediately.
Yeah, right away. They're just like, something's wrong with this guy.
Which by the way, that right off the bat was so interesting to me because this person, the same person, right, is able to come off so well to her and so bad to very close people to her. And presumably she was observing him because it didn't indicate like, you know, it's the one thing if initially he pulled them aside and he's like, I'm actually evil and I want all your guys' money. But that's not the case. It's just they saw his interactions with her and with them and they concluded, okay, there's something wrong with this guy.
Right. So the reason why I think it's a worthy episode for our podcast is the whole story is a case study in a family as it faces a new member of the family who has massive psychological issues.
Yeah.
And how that all plays out and how to see it, I think, is interesting. And so maybe since you introduced that, I think maybe we should go into that a little bit in terms of why do you think that is and how do we see it and how do you think the podcast... The other thing I should say before I forget is that the podcast was made by Christopher Gofford for the LA Times. Mm-hmm. Apparently now publications are making podcasts. Like there was that one that was made by, I think it was like the Des Moines Inquirer or something, or the Ohio and some Midwest, that's called the Inquirer, which I find to be a very unfortunate name because the whole podcast was about they're investigating the murder of this one woman, I think. And it was a pretty interesting episode. And she kept saying, I'm so-and-so from the Inquirer. And I'm like, really, the Inquirer? But that's the National Inquirer.
I see.
Apparently there's like, you know, the Springfield Inquirer.
Okay. Which but makes anyway. Sense. Yeah.
But it's interesting that a lot of these traditional publications are now sponsoring podcasts.
You're trying to find new ways to reach
which audience. Makes total sense because you have a team of reporters, you have an editorial staff,
right?
You have advertisers, you know how to put a story together, you have writers, you know, and so that's what this is this Christopher Gofford, I think that's how you pronounce his name, for the LA Times,
right,
has been doing stories like this all the time, and then they just decided to record all of his conversations with all these people, which is and the way it's all put together and the way he asks questions and the kind of journey that they take you on is pretty interesting. And again, it's, you know, it doesn't take too long, but anyway, so what is our conceptualization of this guy psychologically? Because basically right from the start, so let's just go on this facts. Let's just sort of summarize the facts. He starts dating. Well, let's spoil the whole thing and go back in time.
Well, I mean, when he starts dating her, the facade he's putting for her is almost 100% fabricated. You know, he's not a surgeon or not a true doctor.
Yeah, he's a nurse.
He's a nurse. And he hasn't flown in these missions and things like that. He is actually homeless.
Yeah, he's currently unemployed.
He's currently unemployed.
And he just got out of prison.
He got out of prison.
Yeah. He went into prison for what again? Like, was it money fraud or something? Or
It was because that was the other thing is he comes from a family of basically sort of at least friendly to crime sort of background.
Right. So let's just briefly summarize his life. Yeah. He grows up in a family in which his father was actively encouraging his kids to involve themselves in scams and criminal activity and intimidation. His dad, like, they talk to Dirty John's sister, I think, and the sister is saying things like, our parents were awful, awful people, I think is what she was saying, and they were terrible parents and taught terrible lessons, and it sounds like Dirty John's father was kind of a con man himself and an aggressive person and would say and was like would tell people he was involved with the mob even though it's questionable whether or not that's true.
And then Dirty John adapted that.
Right. It's like Dirty John's just like his dad or a worse version of his dad or something.
Adopted, I mean.
and then Dirty John grows up. The reason why they called him Dirty John is because he was so shady in college and in his 20s that his friends started calling him Dirty John because they just observed his behavior. He was always trying to figure out a scam. He was always working an angle, and he was exploitative of women. And
yeah, I got the sense that a lot of it had to do with his behavior around women. Okay. And they said in that bachelor party interview,
yeah,
they were like, oh, well, you know, I mean, we call him like Filthy John or whatever.
Yeah.
But we can't really talk about why right now.
Right. And so he goes to college and he becomes a nurse and he specializes in anesthesiology. And he starts to work. He gets married and he doesn't invite any of his family to the wedding. He mm-hmm. just totally wants to get away from his family because his family has issues. And
right.
and also, he's already starting to kind of lie about his past. Like, the weird lies, really. Instead right. of saying, because his real name's John, his born name is John, but he starts calling himself Jonathan.
Right.
And he lies about his age. He says he's younger. He says he's 5 years younger
yeah.
to his wife. And then he in the marriage, something goes wrong and the wife wants to divorce him, and that's when he turns on her. Right. Why did she want to divorce him?
Well, remember, there was something about, like, he immediately starts having like affairs and like just sleeping around and stuff like that. Okay. And I don't know if that was the entirety of it, but and remember, they were saying that during the wedding there was a sense of like, these weren't people that he's known all his life, or he like, oh, we grew up together. It was all like people that knew him for like a year in college, you know, like really superficial acquaintances.
Right.
And in fact, I forget, but it was a comment of like, I can't believe he's getting married. Like, you know, it's right. stuff like that.
Yeah. And then she reached out. She found his parents and his siblings and started talking with them.
Yes.
They started telling her information, and she's like, wait, so he's been lying to me about right. his birthday and his name, and what, you know, what else is he lying to me about? And then she divorces him. And it should be noted that these are very attractive people.
Yeah.
Dirty John is an attractive guy. He kind of reminds me of like a pudgy Tom Selleck or something.
yeah.
And anyway, so she divorces him, and he turns on her and becomes very threatening.
Right.
And
by the way, they make a point of saying that in his quote-unquote prime, he was very physically imposing because he was like 6'2", did heavy steroids and weights and stuff. So he was a big guy.
Yeah.
So physically imposing.
Yeah. And so he starts to threaten her, and then she starts to – they have kids together.
Right.
And she starts to record these conversations because she's gone to the police, mm-hmm. and they play some of those tapes on the podcast, and it's pretty interesting. He's like, you know, when you get yours,
yeah,
you'll know it was me.
And she's like, what are you talking about? What yeah, are you threatening me?
Yeah, are you saying, because she's trying to get him to say something yeah. on tape, and he's like, well, you'll know, believe me,
yeah.
one day when you least expect it. Something's going to happen to you, and it's going to be because I made it happen.
And, yeah. You know. And he says, you know, I've been reacquainting myself with part of my family.
Yeah.
That, and he implies it's the mob.
Right.
And just something very bad can happen, you know.
Right. Right. And so, yeah. So then, is that what lands him in prison? Because
there was an actual, he broke the law with some scam or something. Like, I can't remember the details.
Some sort of other scam. And he goes to jail. How long did he go to prison for?
It was years. Like, he was in jail for several years.
Yeah, like 10 years or something.
I don't know if it's that long, but
anyway,
it was a while.
So he emerges from prison yeah. and his sister is trying to help him.
Right.
And trying to get him back on his feet. It's like, okay, you need to get a job. You need to live an honest life, John. You know, let's put aside that bullshit in the past. Let's live an honest life, get a job. And she looks over at the computer screen hoping he's looking for jobs, and he's actually on Match.com
right.
or something like that. And she just looks at him. She's like, really? Like, the day you get out of prison and we're talking about how to build your life, and this is what you want to do with your time?
Right.
And she said she kind of gave up on him at that point. And that's actually when he meets Deborah.
Right.
The star of this podcast, and proceeds to date her, and they fall in love, and they get secretly married. And,
yeah.
And Deborah is in this weird position because all of her family hates him, or many of them do.
Yeah, in some cases, he starts threatening them.
Right.
And well, and it's also interesting because she describes how when she starts trying to date online, she was continuously disappointed.
Right.
You know, she'd meet with these guys and they didn't look as good as in their picture, and they were sort of boring. They didn't get along. And then she goes out with John, and in their date, initially, she's like, oh, this seems really interesting and everything. But when they go to her house,
it should be noted he's always wearing his scrubs.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's always... Yeah, well, oh, are they?
Yeah.
But then when they go to her house or whatever, he tries to get more physical than she wants.
Yeah.
And she made it sound like it got intense, like she had to push him off to the point where he had to apologize later.
Yeah, was it push off? I got the impression that it was aggressive talk. Come on, let's do it.
And if you hear it again, I'm pretty sure she indicated that he tried to.
Okay.
That's not to say like, oh, he raped me or anything. It's just, I think he tried to make moves she was definitely not comfortable with, to the point where he had to apologize.
Right. To the point where she went to like her daughter and said like, yeah, I thought this guy was going to be great, but I ended up having to kick him out of the house.
So that red flag didn't kick in for her.
Well, geez, so we can get into that whole thing.
Yeah.
So, what's the diagnosis, Berto? Like, how do we label him psychologically?
Well, so far, because he seems to lie kind of compulsively about who he is, what he is doing, who he is, et cetera, because he has been fairly dysfunctional and, you know, had to go to jail and messed up, you know, his marriage, all these things, he seems pretty unempathetic in his interactions in those recordings that you hear. And in fact, you know, threatening and, you know, violent even and stuff like that. Like, my layman thing would be to say, I think he's like a psychopath.
Right. So let's go down the symptoms. Long story short, he is a quintessential psychopath. He's a classic case, actually. He's why Hare even developed the measure.
Interesting.
As a way of, and you'll get the picture as we go through the different symptoms. It's like, oh, wow, yeah, this is exactly what this diagnosis, what this label was developed for, was a guy like this.
Well, in fact, what's funny is, before we did our podcasts and before we've talked about this topic, if you had asked me this, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, I would have probably said, oh, I don't know, he seems like a crook, but he's not a psychopath, you know, like with the knife and the killing, which is funny because it will come. But that was interesting because through our conversations about this, I was able to pick up some of those things. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Right. So you're learning. That's good. So symptom number one, is he superficially charming and glib?
Oh, yes.
How so?
Well, that is basically what attracted her to him, is he was able to put on the charm. And then he was described alternatively as either, you know, really odd or charming, you know?
Right.
So that to me indicates that it's something that he could turn on, but wasn't like just part of his normal character.
Right. There were people in her family, including Deborah herself, who were, you know, reported to on this podcast that they thought Dirty John was this really nice guy.
Yeah.
Charming, listened to you, was nice and funny and just a great guy. And then alternatively was a terrible person.
Yeah.
All right. Inflated sense of self-worth.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, in the stories he tells, whether he is fully aware of how much he's exaggerating, he could have gone for a more normal narrative and still be lying, but instead it's like these like hero narratives.
Right.
And then he also, in his conversations, he seems so self-entitled.
Yeah.
Like he's entitled to all the money. He's entitled to all the rights of the family. Like he's just entitled, you know?
Right. So the phrase self-worth is a little weird to me. The way that you phrased it is evidence of what I would say a inflated sort of presentation of self-worth or something. But whether or not he deep down actually felt that way about himself is hard to know.
Sure.
So that's a little bit of a question mark for me. There's really only three question marks, and that's one of them.
I might, as evidenced in that bucket, then I might also throw in the whole, oh, I come from this family of the mob, which seems odd, like it's just a bragging thing, but he's so proud of it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's connected, and that's his background, and right. It's like, really, you would be proud of that? Like,
right. Yeah. A constant need for stimulation. This is actually one of my question marks, but is there evidence for a constant need for stimulation?
Well, there was a thing of like, he liked water stuff, you know, boating, things like that. He also...
But when I hear constant need for stimulation, I think about people who drink a lot, use drugs a lot, who do a lot of extreme sports maybe, who get bored like really easily.
Yeah.
Whereas he didn't present like that.
Okay.
Deborah would talk about him like he would get up and he'd act like he went to work or he'd just stay home.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He played a lot of Call of Duty, you know.
Oh, maybe that's the outlet.
But it's not like a lot of stimulation, you know what I mean? It's like when I apply this label to people that I'm diagnosing, the constant need for stimulation, it's usually like excessive activity in things that often result in self-destruction. You know,
I see.
Lots of sex, lots of masturbation, actually, lots of drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
Lots of
going
out at night.
They did call him Dirty John.
But he didn't apparently cheat on her while they were together.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is he's in his 50s at this point, right?
Yeah.
And psychopathy tends to decrease over the years, or at least the manifestation of the bad behaviors, the annoying behaviors. And so we could say that when he was in college and young that he probably did have that presentation as a drinker and a sexer and all that kind of stuff.
And I mean... Like, okay, the guys they interviewed at the party, to me, and maybe this is unfair, but they seem like very stereotypical, like, frat guys, right?
Yeah.
And they were calling him, oh, that's Dirty John.
Yeah.
So you can kind of maybe imagine he was a party wreck in college, right?
Yeah, yeah. What about lying pathologically?
That, absolutely. Like, nonstop.
Yeah. Just, which is an interesting thing because when I thought about it later, I thought, That is pathological lying in that he didn't need to lie.
No.
Why did he call himself Jonathan instead of John?
Right.
Why did he make his birthday 5 years earlier?
Yeah.
Like to his wife. It's like she's going to find out eventually. She's your wife.
Yeah, actually lies that not only are unnecessary but could destroy your whole point of lying in the first place.
Right.
It's the same thing with the exaggerations. Okay, I could see in this case, if someone's trying to pass off as more legit, it's say like, I do have a job. I'm employed, right? Because if he's unemployed and he's embarrassed about it and stuff. But he's not employed. He's a doctor and an anesthesia doctor. You know, it's like hardcore. They get paid tons of money. They're very well respected. It's a hard profession. And he's been in Doctors Without Borders. Yeah. It's like, 10x the lies.
Right. Right. Being a nurse, anesthesiologist.
Say it again.
Anesthesiologist. is a badass profession, you know, and on the scale of professions.
Yeah, of course.
That's on one side of the bell curve. Let's just put it that way. So why not just keep it at that?
Yeah, that wasn't good enough.
Yeah. Or why not go back to school and become a physician if that's what you want to do? I don't know. Yeah, there's just all these weird little lies that he would do, you know, and that's the definition of pathological lying. Now, the typical way of seeing pathological lying for laymen and among many clinicians, in my experience, is basically at the core of one's personality is something dirty, there's something manipulative and and evil almost about someone who wants to trick people because they like it, or they want to trick people for their own means or something.
I see.
But the the development, I mean, I'm going to cut to the chase and say that my thesis about this guy is he's a tragic figure. He created tragedy around him.
Yeah.
But he clearly, in my view, wanted to live a normal, good life.
Right.
When he got out of prison, he meets Deborah, and he was initially, for a while anyway, this really nice guy.
Yeah.
Now, when you, the sense you get from the story, you know, tellers and particularly the people in the family and whatnot is like, he's evil and he's out to manipulate and he's out to get her money or something.
Yeah.
And that's one way of looking at it. And we'll never be able to answer these questions, like what really motivates any particular human. But the part of it that I didn't think was being talked about was he was, in my view, desperate for attachment. He gets out of prison and he wants a stable relationship, as anyone does. And so he goes on a match. He meets this woman. Maybe he's like, wouldn't it be nice if she actually made a lot of money?
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's a good point. Yeah.
And then he ends up in the relationship with her. And for a while, he's trying to be nice. He's trying to hold together. These other people are starting to threaten his relationship with her. And he gets upset because he really wants to be with Deborah. He reacts in this really dysfunctional way because that's what he was taught. And because he has a psychological condition that makes it so that he can't really think straight in situations like that.
Right.
You know, he jumps to intimidation too quickly. He's threatened too easily. He has too much, he doesn't have enough empathy. You
right,
know, it's
right.
like he needs to think about like, well, you know, if I was there with him in those moments and he's like, so I'm getting the vibe that, you know, and he came to me for therapy. I'm getting the vibe that these people are against me. And so I'm going to really let him have it. And so I would talk with him about, well, what do you want out of this situation? Well, I want to be with Deborah. Well, how do you think this is going to play out if you end up alienating her? You know, there's a, I get that you're worried that you're going to lose Deborah, but there's a better way. And I've talked with people in this,
similar.
not exactly like this guy, but other people in similar situations, you know, there's a lot of notions in our society, particularly around masculinity, that you need to assert yourself, you know, and you need to grab the woman and you need to make it happen and you need to put down your enemies and, you know, just look at Jerry Springer. Everyone's screaming at each other. You know, there's clear messages in our society that say if someone gets in your way, you know, you got to put that down.
Right.
You got to intimidate that person. And so I think that his pathological lying was his desperation for attachment, his desperation for closeness and stability. Because there's so many other ways one can scam money,
right.
you know, other than just dealing with a woman and all of her family members.
Yeah, well, he could have made it a much quicker scam in that case.
Right.
He could have, like, defrauded her by taking all her bank account money or something like that.
And that's what they were kind of implying was, like, he would go from woman to woman and take their money. And he did sometimes do that.
Yeah.
And that I don't have any sympathy for this man.
Of course not.
And I don't have any sympathy for what he did. But I think that the part of the line of thinking that I think wasn't really presented in this podcast is just really typical is the kind of the vibe I'm talking about. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. That makes sense. I think you're right in that, at least from what's been presented, because, you know, we don't know the extent of the other people he actually hurt in his life and stuff like that. But from what's been presented, it did seem like Deborah wasn't being, physically abused, right? Like there was no indication that he was like hitting her or things like that.
Yeah.
And she seemed to want to be in the relationship.
Yeah.
And so maybe it was him not being able to deal with what you're calling what he perceived as threats.
Right.
And that spiraled out of control for him.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was taught a certain thing as a child and he probably had a biological disposition for psychopathy anyway, for lack of empathy and a lack of fear. There's associations with like a lack of fear with psychopathy, which is interesting because when you're a young child and you're developing and your parents look at you with a face of like anger or a face of disapproval,
right?
that activates a young child's fear response. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, my parents are upset at me. Well, imagine if you don't have that fear response in the way that other people do. And because the primary way to modify a child's behavior is to... Sorry, my alarm's going off. That's us telling us that we have to take a break, but let me finish this point. when you look... The primary way of modifying a child's behavior is to look at them and be like, no, stop it, you know, or like, you know, you get an angry face and you say no, and, you know, and imagine if as a 3-year-old, you're just unaffected by that. You're just right. Like, they're putting on that face.
That face, yeah.
That, isn't that funny that they're trying to scare me? I'm not scared. Right. You know, I have no fear. Because you see 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, when you do that to them and they're not ready for it, they freak out.
Yeah.
You know, they jump. They're like, right. Oh my God, you know, like mom's upset at me and what am I doing? You know, you see them have a physiological autonomic response to that.
Right.
And that's an important element in modifying a child's behavior and helping them to understand empathy. Because, you know, 2-year-olds have very little empathy in the way that we hope adults will have. You know, mine, me, give me. This is my, a friend comes by for a play date and has a stuffed animal. And, you know, little Jenny is just like, that is now mine.
That's my stuffed
animal. That's mine now. I see that stuffed animal. I want it. That's mine. That's psychopathic behavior.
Right.
And you're like, you know, hey, have empathy for your play date. It's like, no, this is mine. And hey, we're going to have to give this back to, you know, to Jane, and Jenny's just like, no, my, you know, like, you know, every kid goes through that kind of stuff. And the way you modify psychopathic child behavior is to essentially, one of the ways is to essentially make them afraid. You're not abusing them, but you're like, you're saying sternly, no, this is not okay. And the child's like, oh my God, mom and dad, or what? My parent is upset at me. There, you know, and no one likes to be afraid, right?
No, right.
And so you're like, okay, well, to avoid being made afraid in the future, I am now going to not take Jane's stuffed animal because when I did that, these series of things happened that made me feel terrible.
Right.
So I'm going to avoid that. Well, imagine if you don't have that brain mechanism.
You don't have an incentive to avoid that.
Yeah, you're just like, huh. You're more calm as a 3-year-old thinking through this. You're just like, okay, well, I want that stuffed animal, and my parents are saying these things to me, and I don't really care.
There's no downside.
Yeah. And Jane is upset, because that's the other thing, is now Jane's upset, and if you don't have that fear response to someone else being upset, them retaliating against you, just like, you know, I'm not afraid of that. Yeah, maybe they'll try to smack me around. I don't really care. Then you just don't develop. This is one hypothesis as to why there are psychopaths.
Interesting.
It's not that they don't have empathy. It's that they don't have fear. And it's a weird hypothesis of the development of empathy, right? Is that we develop empathy partially because we're trying to so avoid the fear of what it feels like when we actually harm other people and their response to us and the fact that they might actually get revenge on us, you know?
Interesting.
If I take Jane's thing and I worry that she's going to punch me in the face, or I worry that she's going to take one of my things, or I worry that she's going to tell my mom and then my mom is going to chastise me or spank me or take away something. And that, you know, it's all kind of a fear system.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so as he is lying, you develop this sense of lying because when you lie, you just don't you're not worried about the consequences of lying.
Yeah.
And so you just develop this habit of just like, well, you know, when in doubt, I'll inflate this and I'll inflate that, and even if I get caught, I don't really worry about it. That's what's so strange about psychopaths is that's why I love this podcast so much, because if you really look at Dirty John, his life is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
he's not like this calculated mastermind, which is how often they're presented. And if you don't really listen carefully, I feel like this podcast presents him as a mastermind. You know, he's like a con man. He's always like figuring out how to manipulate people and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I mean, did you get that sense?
Well, I got more of the sense that he's always trying to forcefully manipulate, but I didn't get the sense that he was often as successful.
Good, you know? Because he was not successful.
Yeah.
This man, when he meets Deborah, is coming out of prison. He's homeless.
Right.
He doesn't have a job, and he doesn't even have any clothes.
Yeah.
And it's you know, because psychopaths are often presented in the media.
They're rich. They live in a castle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
they're smart.
Yeah, they're always like really good at manipulating
people.
They're
playing six chess games at the same time.
Right. Whereas you look at this guy's life, and stupid choice after stupid choice.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do you want out of life, John? Do you want to end up in prison again? Do you want to end up dead, as what happened in the case? Or would you rather just have a fun, good life? Well, here's the normal path to a fun, good life. You know, get a job,
right.
Be a normal human being, don't threaten people, don't lie, don't give people a reason to look into your past. Because that's the whole thing, like, he kept pushing people and kept pushing people. And eventually, they're just like, "I'm gonna look into this guy's past.
I'm gonna get a lawyer."
Yeah, what is wrong with this guy?
Yeah,
and
like when he's on that phone call with, is it the son-in-law of her, like Deborah's son-in-law, I think, or something like that?
Well, a major character is Deborah's nephew.
Oh, nephew. Yeah, and he, you know, they're having this heated conversation, and the nephew keeps trying to draw these lines in the sand, like, I'm not going to let you do that to our family or something. And John, like, doesn't care. He's like, why didn't you come here? Come here. Tell me. Just come here. You know?
Right.
And you know, clearly, John won't back down. He's like, I don't care. I'm going to take it to the limit. He pushes and pushes and pushes.
Right. And it's like, to what end, Dirty John? Like, what is your goal here?
Yeah.
Right? If your goal is to have a good life and to, you know, that's the thing about psychopathology, is that, such as personality disorders, is that it's not a well thought out approach to life.
Right.
And it ends up, you end up shooting yourself in the foot, which is why this podcast, you know, Dirty John is a good presentation of that and really lays that out well. And I really hope that listeners, when they listen to this, they go, oh, I get it. Psychopaths are tragic individuals who create a wake of tragedy around them, but the most tragic figure is often the individual doing these things.
Like,
I don't get the sense this guy was a happy individual. Do you know what I mean?
He might have had pockets of happiness, but overall, no.
I doubt it. I got the sense like this guy was in a daily basis feeling like crap, because that's often the case. You're just in a constant state of worry about losing your attachments. Mm. You're in a constant state of the traumas he went through when he was a kid that he didn't process, in a constant state of remembering like all the disappointment that he's been through in life and trying to deny that and everything. Anyway, let's take a break. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast, do so now by going to patreon.com. Once you become a patron, you get access to a lot of our patron-only episodes. Okay, let's continue with the psychopathic symptoms. So we got superficial charm, inflated sense of self-worth, constant need for stimulation, lying pathologically. What about conning others and being manipulative?
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, he was emotionally manipulative in what I heard in the podcast, and he was definitely always trying to sort of get the edge, but using threats.
Yeah,
a lot of them violent threats.
But he also, I think, in line with this symptom, is the lying about Doctors Without Borders.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's a very conning. Yeah. You're trying to manipulate. He's trying to manipulate Deborah and other women to respect him more and stuff.
Oh, and like the Scrubs thing.
Yeah.
Like, what was it that he didn't have any other clothes? I didn't think so.
That's the thing. Like, the Scrubs alone. So people didn't listen to them. He would wear these dirty Scrubs all the time. And other people in the family who know physicians know that you don't wear your scrubs to like a Thanksgiving dinner.
No.
and so.
And if your scrubs are dirty from the street, you can't use them in the hospital.
Right. So, you know, the fact that he's, that's what, this is psycho, the 99.9% of psychopaths are like this. They're stupid. They're trying so hard, it becomes obvious. Mm. And that's why so Deborah's in love with Dirty John. She's just like, oh, he's dashing. I want love. And so as anyone, you'll get clouded to reality. But the family members, you know, her kids and other people, they're not in love with him. So they're looking at him, you know, without rose-colored glasses. Right?
Yeah.
And it's immediately apparent upon meeting him that something's up with this guy.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about psychopathy is like these are not geniuses. They're not good at manipulating other people. They're quite obvious. Like when you interact with them, you'll pretty quickly realize, something's up with this guy.
Yeah.
You'll feel it.
Like the daughter meets him and she's immediately like, he's a slob. He's just like moping around the house.
Yeah.
You know? And she's immediately turned off by him.
Yeah. I was interpreting all of that initial reactivity from the two daughters as them picking up on something. When you interact with someone who doesn't have empathy, you feel it in your bones. Mm. I do. When I interact with someone who has a personality disorder that has an element of a lack of empathy, I feel it in my bones right away.
Interesting.
There's something unnerving about someone without empathy, even if you don't have evidence that they don't have empathy. There's something about facial expressions. It's weird. Like they might be saying things like, oh, that's interesting, but you get a sense like they're not sincere.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so you, in your bones, in your all of your brain power that's spent on picking up on facial cues, mm-hmm. and you know, nonverbal cues,
yeah,
is alarm bells are going off. Like something's incongruent here. I don't know what, you know, your brain doesn't know psychopath, but your brain is like, something's kind of off,
right,
in this situation. You know,
like all the usual back and forth I get to do with people, it's not right.
Yeah, there's something different here. And we're, I think, programmed or evolved to, when we pick up on incongruencies and something's off, we tend to get a little afraid because we like things to feel familiar. And so, sure, when something doesn't feel familiar, we get a little afraid. And so I think that was my, you know, it's reading into it quite a bit, but that was my guess as to what was happening. So the next symptom here, lack of remorse or guilt. Did he exhibit that?
Lack of remorse. Well, I don't think he ever felt anything was his fault.
No.
Nothing.
No. He did empirically horrible things that we heard about. Yeah. No evidence of remorse or guilt.
He was always a victim.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the things that he would do and say, it's like, how about just say you're sorry, you know? Or how about just sort of say, He just relentlessly was aggressive verbally with people,
yeah,
just at the drop of a hat. Even again, as it started to escalate with Deborah's family, he just kept at it, you know.
Yeah.
So, what about shallow emotions?
Well, that one, it's a little hard because I'm assuming yes. I am still intrigued. What was the deal with that? Because Deborah had lost her sister, right?
Right. So Deborah's sister was murdered by the sister's husband.
And then there was also something else, which is maybe not a thing, but Deborah's, remind me, who was the person in the end who he fights with?
That's Deborah's daughter. Tara.
Okay. There's something in her voice.
Yeah.
That I found interesting. She had that sort of voice, like she went through some tough times young. It could be
Well, you're
nothing.
Doing the Dr. Drew thing.
Yeah, it could be nothing, but there was something in her voice. So I sort of had this sense, like, maybe we don't know the whole story about Deborah's past in the sense of why she might find it irresistible to be attracted to someone like John.
Yeah.
And that we don't necessarily have all the pieces. But there must be something there because just because you like someone, he wasn't in her life for 10 years, you know? It was a fairly quick, strong, intense attachment that developed for someone who was not a teenager. She was 50, you know, in her 50s.
Age has nothing to do with that.
Well, I guess, but age does give you experience, you know, like...
No, not in my... You would like to think, and that's the cultural notion, that somehow adults are better able to manage love relationships, and I'm here to tell you that is just not my experience.
No, maybe not.
I mean, but certainly 15-year-olds might have a little bit more of a deficit, but the propensity to fall in love quickly and be...
I guess what I was trying to say was, if she was on the level, then he must have had enough actual emotions that she could work with. Otherwise, why would she have been so attached to him?
Well, so, good question. Yeah, this is the other question mark for me, is the emotion part. And you're good to sort of wonder, maybe when it was just the two of them, and there wasn't any threats that were happening on the outside, that there was a depth of emotion that Deborah was picking up on that she appreciated, right?
Yeah,
totally. I didn't see, there's no evidence to me in terms of what they presented that he had shallow emotions. But he might have.
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
I guess part of what I was saying with age is when I started dating, or I imagine when someone starts dating, in general, you sort of don't know what's right and what's wrong, like what you even are supposed to expect out of dating someone, you know, because you see in movies like, okay, the thing is dating. But in reality, like, what's it supposed to feel like? What am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
So I imagine when you're young and you start dating someone, let's say you're a girl and you start dating a guy. If the guy sort of like doesn't say too many things, he doesn't cry in movies, whatever, like any number of things. How are you supposed to know if that's normal or not normal? The only thing you could base it on is, well, are my brothers like that? Is my dad like that? Is my uncle like that? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But if you've dated throughout your life, maybe you at least have some frames of reference of like,
yeah,
you know, this guy never compliments me or something, you know, things like that.
Yeah, I'll give you that, yeah. What about callousness and lack of empathy?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
I think, certainly. Yeah. At least in his words and final actions.
Yeah.
We also don't know if he did worse things that we, you know, yeah, neither us nor the police know about.
What about using others and being a parasite?
Definitely he was perceived as a parasite by the entire family except Deborah.
Yeah. He's a classic psychopathic parasite,
yeah,
in that he found a woman who had money and just proceeded to be a parasite off,
yeah,
of her. So there's that. What about poor control over behavior?
Yeah. I mean... Like you're saying, I didn't get the sense that when he was blowing up on the phone and saying all these threats, like it was this part of a master plan. It, yeah, was him losing control.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Promiscuous sexual behavior.
Well, so two things. There was the indication in college. That, I mean, they made very, very poignant comments about how he was around women and what he did with women without going into graphic detail because they're like, we don't want to talk about it. The second thing was when he was no longer with Deborah, there was that thing about how he had been seeing women like nonstop. Do you remember this? Like, was it his sister? I think it was his sister that was saying that he was seeing women, or maybe this was before he started seeing Deborah.
Yeah.
I can't quite remember. The sister was saying something about it that she realized that John was just like going through women and dating them.
Plenty of fish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So definitely promiscuous sexual behavior when he was younger and maybe during his adult, older adult life too. Behavioral problems early in life.
Well, I don't remember if they talked about him getting in trouble in school and stuff like that, but it sounds like he was always a troublemaker.
Right. This is basically a symptom to demonstrate that it's been a lifelong behavioral pattern,
yeah,
related to his personality.
Have you seen the movie It, the new one?
No, is it good?
I liked it, yeah. Maybe if you watch it, we should talk about it.
I'm not into horror. Do you think it would be good to watch?
I don't know. If you're not into horror, maybe it's not. But it's not a cheesy horror movie. It's
actually
Stranger Things.
Yeah, I heard it's kind of like Stranger Things.
It's like Stranger Things. Someone described it as Goonies meets... What was the other movie they compared it to? Stand By Me or something. You know, like... Okay. But it is horror. I mean, it's, you know, all right, scary things.
Lack of realistic long-term goals.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly.
Yeah, his entire life is one... Lack of realistic long-term goal. What about being impulsive?
He was impulsive in his reactions towards people.
Totally.
For sure. Yeah,
he was very impulsive. Being irresponsible.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, he's extremely irresponsible. Blaming others and refusing to accept responsibility.
Yes, and even... Because I was going to say about the irresponsibility, but I think it also applies in this one. Remember the story about how... He started, like, he wasn't even doing a good job as a nurse,
right?
Anesthesiologist.
Yeah.
And it was causing patients to, like,
yeah,
come out early and, like, all sorts of problems.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. He was taking drugs from work and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Blaming others. Yeah. Having several marital relationships. Yes.
Yes.
Delinquency when young. Yes.
Yes.
Criminal acts in several realms.
In several realms. Well, we know for a fact he tried to kill someone.
Yeah.
We know also...
Well, that's debatable.
Oh, what?
Yeah. But anyway, well, at the very least, he was assaultive extreme.
Wait, why do you think it's debatable?
Well, let's continue with this.
Okay.
Yeah, he was like a money fraud. He would steal stuff from his work in terms of drugs. There were several realms of criminality.
Yes.
The idea is that you have a general personality problem that leads to general criminality.
Yeah.
It, you know, someone who doesn't have a personality problem like psychopathy will tend to be a criminal in one area, you know,
yeah,
like I steal makeup or I rob banks or something.
Right.
But when I'm not robbing banks, it's not like I'm just impulsively a criminal, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's go to the very end. The twist at the end is he is trying to intimidate Tara, the daughter,
right,
to back off.
Oh, is that why you're saying it? You're saying that he might have just been trying to scare her?
Yeah. I mean, if he wanted to just take her out, and this is, I think, what they speculated, what the LA Times guy was speculating, was like, He went to Tara to try to intimidate her with a knife, but didn't plan on actually using it on her.
But
I don't remember the exact.
Remember,
you know,
that in his trunk they found a rope, duct tape, other stuff. Now again, to your point though, he may be having tons of fantasies,
yeah,
but not fully intending to go through with it.
Right,
which is still bad enough. Right?
Yeah, well, fantasies, yeah. But and they said like he was kind of weak and whatnot.
He had lost. So they said that at his peak, he was like 225 pounds or 230
he was
pounds.
Like 120 pounds.
And he was, it was down to 130, 120.
Yeah.
It's like crazy.
Yeah.
Like
because
immense,
he had to,
emaciated.
Yeah. So what happens is Dirty John has this massive stomach problem. He's in the hospital for like a month. And Deborah decides now this is when I'm going to leave. And so she gets all of his stuff, puts it in the garage and blah, blah, blah. And then that's when Dirty John kind of escalates from there.
Yeah.
And Tara, this like 5'0".
No, she's 5'4", right?
Oh, well, she's really small is the thing.
Yeah, but she's not big. He's 6'2".
Yeah. He's waiting for her like outside of her car or something.
Right.
And he tries to intimidate her. They get into a scuffle and he starts to stab her.
He stabs at her, yeah.
Yeah, and stabs her like several times.
Although, yeah, yes, right.
And then...
Her arm is particularly badly stabbed.
Yeah, and then the knife gets out of his hands, which is actually really common in knife fights like this because blood makes things really slippery. And then she grabbed the knife and proceeded to like stab him a bunch of times. And then stabs him through the eye.
Through the eye.
And kills him. And
although he doesn't, no, he doesn't die right away. Remember, he goes into a coma.
Well, no, he was brain dead.
Okay, fine. But he still had a pulse.
Right. So they were, the paramedics arrived. They were, they like get his heart going, right. Yeah, but his brain was dead.
Right.
And
right.
So they pulled him off the, you know, life support a few days later. So essentially, you know, she turned off his brain.
She basically, yeah.
And so it is just totally, I did not see that coming. I'm like, I thought what was going to happen was he was going to end up in jail, because as I'm listening to the podcast, I'm like, well, we haven't heard from him,
yeah.
And they haven't said what happens to him, and Deborah's kind of talking like he's out of the picture now.
Right.
So where is he, you know, or did he kill himself or something? And so, it's kind of, so there's two scenarios here. One is that he showed up, he wanted to get revenge on Tara, and he flubbed it, and she ended up killing him.
Yeah. Wait, it was, by the way, the whole podcast opens with, and there's 10 knife wounds, and there's stab in the neck, or, you know, like,
there's, oh, I don't remember
police,
that. I don't remember that.
The podcast opens with this police description of all these stab wounds. So immediately I was expecting, okay, we're going to hear about all the victims that this guy killed and all these things. So it was actually quite interesting that he might have, but we never hear about any deaths until he dies.
Right. And that's another thing. I assume he hasn't killed anybody.
Right.
And I assume that, yeah, he had fantasies because he had all that stuff in the trunk, or he had the stuff in the trunk because he wanted to intimidate people.
Yeah, he might have actually wanted to kidnap her.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, again, the guy is terrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
No.
But,
and right. But again, if you want to kill someone, if you just want to murder someone, get a gun. It's obviously easy in our country to get a gun.
Right.
And just walk up behind him and kill him. Like, why would you show up with, and it wasn't even like a huge knife. It was like,
right. Yeah.
You know, and so there's all that kind of stuff. And, so there's one scenario where he showed up, he wanted to kill her, he wanted to bound her, you know, bind her and dump her, or he wanted to kidnap her and intimidate her and then set her free, and, you know, and then she, you know, she would be intimidated and not talk shit about him anymore or something, or he would just feel better getting revenge. And it's hard to know, but the most comical thing about it is Tara and her husband are really into Walking Dead.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So early in the podcast, they go on this long jag about how Tara, so Deborah's daughter, you know, the daughter who hated John from the beginning, they go on this long jag about how Tara met her boyfriend and how they started dating. And I'm like, why are we going down this road? And they start talking about how they bonded over The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And there's these lines of Tara talking about, yeah, I just kind of like Walking Dead because, you know, it kind of teaches you like survival skills. And, you know, it's just kind of interesting to think about, like, what if the zombie apocalypse did happen and you had to defend yourself? You know, it's just good life. She's treating it like it's a life skills kind of.
Survivor Man.
Yeah. And then she talks about after killing, you know, through self-defense, killing Dirty John, she attributes her success in that altercation to watching The Walking Dead.
You got to get him in the head.
Yeah.
You got to get him in the head.
She says something like that.
Yeah.
Like, you got to get...
That's how you get the zombie.
You can't kill him in the body. You got to get him in the head. And that's what she did. She stabbed him through the eye.
Right.
And
which is a common thing to do in The Walking Dead.
Right.
Because it's a lot easier to drive a knife through an eyeball than it is through a skull.
Is it?
Well, yeah, I mean.
Is it?
I mean, an eyeball is fluffy and
But I mean, squishy. you have skull behind. Yeah, but
you don't have to, you know. Plus, there's a little gap at the back. You know, there's a little gap. you don't have to worry yourself with all the details.
I just thought, the way they presented it or the way I took it. I mean, did you take it as kind of comical?
Yeah, although I guess in the moment I wasn't laughing just because I was still sort of like, I was actually putting myself in the situation of seeing this happening and like, just like, oh my gosh, how do you stop something like that? You know, in the middle of it.
Yeah.
See, you know, I was imagining there's this scuffle, and even if you know clearly who's the aggressor, there's a knife and like the mess of that situation, you know? And so that gal that came out and she was like trying to help out and stuff like that, like that would be so messy, you know, so scary and messy. Yeah. So I see what you're saying. It's like I played Call of Duty and now I know how to, you know, how to fight.
Yeah. All right. The final word about this is that it's a great podcast. It's short. If you're interested in this kind of thing, maybe you're not. It's not scary like other scary podcasts are. It's more of a case study of an abusive person who it also kind of teach you about domestic violence, actually, and interpersonal, intimate partner violence, in that he solely isolated Deborah from the family. He would lie. He would do bad things. Deborah would threaten to leave, and then he would beg her to come back. He was extremely nice to her on certain times, and would kind of make her depend on him in certain ways.
Right.
And was very traditional in some ways. And so it's a good case. It's a good case study in domestic violence as well. And one of the most shocking parts that you sort of alluded to earlier was that at some point Deborah totally leaves him.
Yeah.
You know, for good. You're just like, as you're hearing this story, you're like, Deborah, leave this guy.
Right.
Leave this guy. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. And then finally she leaves him. and then she lets him back into her life.
Yeah.
And then they secretly get married.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And the whole time you're just like, Deborah, why? There's so many other fish in the sea. Why this guy? And the part that I didn't think they portrayed well enough was the romance that is involved in these kinds of things. She talked about how she's like, well, you know, I was in love with him.
Yeah.
And
she doesn't say like, I'm finally so glad because I didn't see how much he was hitting me and abusing me and stuff. She talks about him in those ways of like, I really was in love with him.
Right. And we all have to forgive our spouses for their faults. That's a requirement. In order to be in a long-term relationship, you have to forgive, even without them apologizing.
Right, right.
You have to tolerate your spouse's shortcomings. That's just part of the
gig. Goes with the territory.
And so it's hard for people to know what's too much fault, you know? And I also love this person. I need this person. I depend on this person emotionally. It feels good when things are good. And what if I never meet anybody else? You know, these are questions I hope everyone can relate to. And they make it really hard in that situation. And right. And it, you know, the way it's often presented is like, well, you know, he tricked her and he manipulated her. And certainly you could say that, but you could also just say like, look, you know, love is blind. It's hard to quantify the good feelings that she was getting. Yeah. Why did I say it like that?
The good feelings she was getting. You know, it occurs to me, I've never understood when someone gets together with someone else and they sort of turn off the rest of their relationships.
Yeah.
That's always been very puzzling to me. I can understand to a certain extent, like, well, if you're going to try to build a relationship together, you maybe have to not spend as much time with everyone else. That makes sense. But I've seen it a few times in my life where someone starts dating a person and they sort of like, because of that relationship, cut ties left and right in seemingly unnecessary ways. And I've always been like, wait, if that person is making you change your social circle so dramatically, how, and second, why, right? Like, why do you do that?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that, obviously. One is, right, that the new spouse is threatened by the friends and will create enough problems for the person that the person's like, it's just easier if I just avoid my friends.
Right.
Another is that for, you know, your friend, they might have, there's a certain attachment style that lends itself to becoming when you start a relationship. So you have a bunch of friends, but you have basically an insecure attachment style.
Yeah.
You find someone to attach to, and you put all your eggs in that basket because you're so desperate for that closeness.
I see.
And you yourself don't even want to hang out with your friends because you don't want anything to interfere with that that little bit of security you have with that person.
It's fascinating. So I feel like that's why I was saying earlier that there must have been something on her end.
Oh yeah.
That made it so she was so attracted to this kind of situation.
Right. So there's two things. One is that yes, because she very much comes across and even I think says that she feels like she's kind of a naive, trusting person. So there's that. But another part of this is that it's very possible that she suffered from attachment issues herself. Yeah. And when this guy came along who was extremely giving, you know, he was very nice to her,
yeah,
would do her dry cleaning, would make dinner for her,
right,
complimented her all the time, told her, I want to marry you, you know, right away. He's like, I want to be with you forever. And like, there's a very seductive quality to these kinds of people. And so this is why I'm throwing in a little borderline in here. I think he had a little of that. And maybe all psychopaths have a little bit of borderline in them. I don't know. But he certainly had that need for closeness and that attachment and security that I think he was manifesting. The other side to this whole thing, you know, aside from looking for issues that she was suffering, is you can take the healthiest human being on the planet, someone who is the most securely attached, has the most, you know, psychological resources, has the most social resources, is privileged, blah 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 blah. And you have them fall in love with someone who has these, even like 5% of these qualities that Dirty John has. And that person will have a hard time extracting themselves once the relationship turns abusive. Abusive relationships, if you've never been in one or you've never been close to one, you probably don't really understand it because it's a very particular experience to go through. It's very scary. The fact that you feel perpetually scared of, you know, with Deborah, after a while, as she started to learn more about Dirty John and his lying, imagine what would go through your head in terms of like, what is this guy capable of?
Yeah, right.
If I break up with him, you know, I can imagine him doing all sorts of terrible things.
Right.
And so why risk that, one? Two, if I just do some mental gymnastics, I can, you know.
Isn't so bad.
It's not so bad. And it's all based on fear, though. And so there's a chance that Deborah was experiencing that, or at least partially.
Interesting.
And, you know, because that's what people say. It's like, why don't you just leave him? You know, why don't you just leave the asshole? And it's like, unless you have the sort of gumption to actually kill the guy.
Yeah.
And he's going to be walking around able to do things. And if you've ever been in that position where you're afraid that someone's going to take you out, you know that the world is a very unsafe place.
Wow.
Like, you know, your house is only so secure and you've got to leave at some point.
Yeah.
You know, if someone wants to kill you or kill someone you love and get away with it, it's actually not that hard.
Right.
You know?
You can't like draw up an actual barrier around yourself and everyone you care
about. Yeah, you can't have a bulletproof barrier all the time.
Right.
And plus, you just sort of think like, well, even if I did have all these measures, do I really want to lay awake at night worrying something's going to happen?
Yeah.
And so it's so scary and so pervasive that you just say, well, it's not that bad, you know. And there's good times, and as long as I don't push those buttons,
don't rock the boat,
he's okay. And so now that's a slippery slope, and it just gets, you know, the guy gets worse and worse, and it's just a tiny little step down the road, and before you know it, you're in this like super super dysfunctional, horrible, abusive relationship. Jeez. And you have a lot of mental, you know, defenses to to essentially protect. It's a weird way of protecting the self, you know?
And it's also a little bit of the gambler's dilemma where you'll feel like, I've invested so much in this.
Yeah.
I can't walk away now. Right. Like,
so interesting podcast. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.